going to the call page and clicking on the link provided. We will be monitoring all of the comments and questions throughout the call, and we'll read questions to the speaker after his presentation. Right now, everyone has been muted with the exception of our moderator and our speaker. As I noted, the call will last 30 minutes, and it is being recorded. With that, I'm going to hand things over to you, Carol.
Thank you, Chris. I'm Carol Kwiatkowski, the Executive Director of TEDx, and I want to welcome everyone to the first presentation in our teleconference series. We are so pleased to be able to provide this service that directly connects scientists with people from academia, government, healthcare, and the general public. We do have over 100 people on the line, up to 150 possibly, and we want to have questions for time at the end, so I'm not going to delay. I will introduce our speaker, Dr. Chris Cassotis, who is a postdoctoral research associate at Duke University. He has published several studies on the topic of our teleconference series. Many of those were conducted in collaboration with Dr. Susan Nagel at the University of Missouri, where they assessed unconventional oil and gas operations as a novel source of endocrine disrupting chemicals, as well as the potential for exposure to those chemicals to lead to adverse human and animal health outcomes. And the timing couldn't be better, as just yesterday, Dr. Cassotis' work on endocrine disruptors in fracking wastewater in West Virginia was published. So you will be some of the first to hear about that, and soon you will be able to download that from our website on the call page. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to you, Dr. Cassotis, for your presentation.
Thanks, Carol. Hi, everyone. Thanks for being here today. I have to thank Carol and the folks at TEDx for allowing me to come and share some of our recent work with you all today. I'm very excited about the next two webinars in this series as well, so make sure you register for those. So as Carol said, I'm now a postdoc at Duke University, and I transitioned a bit out of the world of fracking at this point for my work there and into other environmental mixtures, though I still have plenty of work for my PhD program at MU that will be coming out before too long, including, as Carol alluded to, one publication this week that I'll talk about a bit today. So if we move to slide two, the outline of the talk, I'll give a short introduction on hormones and endocrine disrupting chemicals, which is the focus of our work, then a very short explanation of hydraulic fracturing. I assume probably everyone here is pretty familiar with that concept. I'll spend the remainder of my time discussing some new data, some of it published just yesterday on surface water quality surrounding an oil and gas wastewater injection disposal site, and some on gestational exposure experiment in mice. We've published some of this mouse work, specifically some data on male mice in October, and are just about ready to submit the female data for peer review. So without further ado, slide three. I'm sure many of you are familiar with endocrine disruptors, but if we step back for one moment, hormones are essentially the chemical messengers of the body, regulating numerous processes during development and for maintenance throughout our lives. Pictured here are five well-described hormone receptors, and this is just meant to give you an idea of the vast number of developmental and maintenance processes that these hormones regulate. Also, it's meant to communicate how there's a lot of overlap between these systems. It's rarely one hormone that regulates a single process in the body. Slide four. So the Endocrine Society defines an endocrine-disrupting chemical as a chemical or mixture of chemicals in the environment that interferes with any aspect of hormone action. This disruption can occur through two main mechanisms. The first is through direct interactions. So in this case, we have chemicals that are able to mimic the actions of endogenous hormones, acting as receptor agonists. These can bind to hormone receptors and drive a receptor-mediated biological response. Antagonists, on the other hand, can bind to hormone receptors and prevent the endogenous hormone from binding, and thus prevent that biological response. The other main mechanism is through indirect interactions, and this can occur through a variety of different mechanisms. Endocrine disruptors can influence where and how frequently receptors are expressed in various tissues throughout the body. They can modulate hormone levels in the bloodstream, and they can even influence how a receptor responds to binding its natural hormone, among other mechanisms. Slide five. Ultimately, these chemicals can disrupt the developmental and maintenance processes I described before and can lead to a host of adverse health outcomes. These have all been described in controlled animal models, and most, if not all, have been associated with endocrine-disrupting chemical exposure in human epidemiological studies. Slide 6. So I'm sure everyone in the U.S. And probably around the world is at this point familiar with this popular ProPublica fracking graphic. Very generally, this process couples two technologies. The first, horizontal drilling. Industry is able to drill down thousands of feet to a shale or coal bed gas layer and can then turn the drill bit horizontally and drill through that layer for up to 2 miles. This is then coupled with hydraulic fracturing itself, which involves the high-pressure injection of millions of gallons of water mixed with sand and proppants into the well. The force serves to fracture this layer, and the proppants, which are typically finely grained silica sand particles, prop open these fractures, and the trapped oil and gas particles are able to flow out of the layer and be collected at the surface. Now, if you missed this past week, Rob Jackson and Dominic DiGiulio published work confirming drinking water contamination by fracking in Pavilion, Wyoming. This has been a very contentious area. So I did want to note that while we often think of fracking only occurring at thousands of feet below the surface, in many areas like Pavilion, it is happening at or directly below the water table. Slide 7. So in this graph, the yellow and green graphic denotes the surge in unconventional oil and gas production, oil production over the last 10 years. The darker orange line in the middle, which is steady across the graph, denotes conventional oil production. This has stayed steady over the same time period. And the dark blue line is the U.S. oil rig count in several major oil production basins, which you can see has plummeted recently. So currently, due to the extremely low oil and gas prices, we have about 60% of U.S. oil rigs idling, and the Energy Information Association expects a drop of approximately 600,000 barrels a day of oil production this year. The same largely applies to natural gas, largely due to oversupply and a warm winter. However, while new wells are being drilled at a reduced rate, it's important to note that most of our current wells continue to produce. Slide 8. So in the upper left here, you have the typical proportions that we think of for hydraulic fracturing. The total injected mass is typically around 7% proppant, 91% water, and about 1% of a chemical mixture, though this graphic focuses solely on the fluid portion. That may seem like a small amount of chemicals, though with an average injection volume of about 2.5 million gallons, even 1% is a very large amount of chemicals going into each and every well. Now, more recently, matrix acidizing and acid fracking have been getting more attention. Notably in the Monterey Shale in California. I'll just suffice it to say for our purposes today that in many of these cases we're talking about a considerably higher percent of total chemicals in the injected mixture. Slide 9. So in this graphic, which we adapted with permission of the Checks and Balances Project, it really highlights some of the pathways associated with fracking contamination of water. Surface water can be impacted by surface spills during the transportation, fracking, and recovery processes through leaks of the wastewater storage pit, in some cases unlined. Faulty cement well casings have been shown to be a concern in several publications now and are a path for contamination of groundwater, as well as our surface spills. And lastly, there's still a lot we don't know about the fractures occurring underground and potential for migration of these fluids over time into groundwater. Slide 10. So we'd largely got interest in this topic through the work of Theo Colburn and TEDx. This 2011 paper assessed 353 chemicals that could be identified by chemical abstract service number at that time, and found that as many as 37% of these, there was some suggestion in the literature that they might be EDCs, or endocrine-disrupting chemicals. So that spurred a number of years of work in the lab and the bulk of my dissertation work at University of Missouri. So slide 11, just to kind of summarize some of our previously published work, we've showed greater estrogenic, anti-estrogenic, and anti-androgenic activities in surface and groundwater near drilling dense sites with a history of fracking fluid spills in Garfield County, Colorado. That was published online in late 2013. We also tested 24 commonly used fracking chemicals directly for their ability to inhibit or activate 5-hormone receptors, and found that they largely antagonized or inhibited these receptors. We have also done a good amount of work now with Dr. Chung-Ho Lin at the University of Missouri to start measuring and determining chemicals present in both unconventional wastewater samples and also in surface and groundwater samples in these regions. And lastly, we've started to publish some data on health effects in male mice exposed only during gestation to a mixture of fracking chemicals. Slide 12. So just for anyone who's not aware of how a lot of these cell-based tests are done, so in this case, we take human cancer cells and we insert a small piece of circular DNA into for a specific hormone receptor and a hormone response element linked with the firefly luciferase gene. And this is what makes fireflies glow. The idea behind these assays is that if you then add a hormone into the system, it will bind to the hormone receptor. That receptor will bind to the hormone response element and it will drive production of the firefly luciferase protein. We can then add a substrate in the lab and measure luminescence as an output to determine the amount of hormone that is bound. Slide 13. So by using known concentrations of hormones, we can construct dose response curves where low concentrations drive almost no luminescence production and higher concentrations produce progressively more until the response peaks. Chemicals that activate the receptor are shown as solid lines in this graph. And we can also assess the decline in luminescence from that level when we co-expose to inhibitory chemicals. And we can use that to assess antagonism of these receptors shown in the dotted lines here. Slide 14. So in our most recent work, available online now, we worked with a group from the U.S. Geological Survey, led by Denise Acob, to assess surface water quality around an oil and gas wastewater disposal site in West Virginia. So here we have a Class II injection disposal well, shown in greater detail at the lower right, along with several produced water ponds maintained on the site that are now closed. Wolf Creek flows through this site, and several samples were collected both prior to the site, upstream, on the site, downstream from the site, and in a nearby reference stream with no known oil and gas influence. These samples were collected, stored on ice, shipped to our lab, where they were extracted and applied to our cells to assess the receptor activities. Slide 15. What you'll see is that in our reference sites, so those are bracketed here, both upstream of the site, in the reference stream, as well as in the field blank, there's very little or no significant antagonist activity for the 5 receptors. Now, site 6 occurs near the injection site on the well pad and has considerably more activity. Site 7, downstream of the former wastewater ponds, has an even greater amount, and site 3, which is downstream of the entire site, exhibits near maximal inhibition across the 5 receptors. And importantly, this is then independent of cell toxicity. I should also note that this is all using 4x concentrated water samples, so it is not directly water that you would be drinking, but we are concentrating it a little bit to better assess the activity. Slide 16. If we look at agonist activities, first note the considerably reduced scale. There does appear to be some background agonist activity in the surface water upstream and in the reference site, although the high levels of antagonism present downstream appear to completely inhibit this activities in samples 6, 7, and 3. Slide 17. So in summary here, we've seen elevated antagonist activities in surface water downstream from an oil and gas wastewater disposal site. Interestingly, concurrent work performed by Denise Acob and Bill Oram and their teams from USGS have demonstrated that there are clear impacts on unconventional oil and gas wastewater on stream quality. So while this doesn't conclusively link the activities that we report to oil and gas operations, it is very suggestive that this is indeed the source, or a large portion of it. Also, we can compare the levels of receptor activity to well-described hormones or test chemicals and determine what are essentially equivalent activities to determine potential health effects. We might not know what 20% estrogen activation means in our assay, but we can convert that to a known concentration of, for example, 17-beta-estradiol that elicits that 20% response in our assay. And then, based on that concentration, can estimate likely health effects from that known concentration. So now we then correct for the concentration of our sample, and we report then a equivalent concentration of 17-beta-estradiol at the standard 1x water concentration. So here, in this case, the antagonist equivalent activities for all five receptors were at levels known to result in adverse health effects for aquatic organisms, such as fish, snails, and other macroinvertebrates, primarily on reproductive and developmental endpoints, including the feminization of fish, reduced egg production, disrupted ovarian follicle development, and disrupted body and organ development. Importantly, this site is miles upstream from any drinking water collection, so we don't know about potential impacts on humans living nearby. However, this work clearly demonstrates that additional work needs to be done at more of these sites. Slide 18. We do know that there have been a number of studies now reporting increased risks of adverse health outcomes for humans and animals in these regions. Teams from Yale and also Bamberger and Oswald from Cornell have published a series of articles now assessing health effects in both humans and animals living near natural gas operations. Importantly, I'll point out the most recent Bamberger and Oswald publication in 2015 showed a symptom abatement in many cases for families and animals that left drilling regions. There have also been a number of epidemiological studies now that have reported associations in humans with increased rates of congenital heart defects, preterm birth, and low birth weight babies. Dr. Stacy will actually be presenting her work next month, so be sure to tune in for that teleconference as well. Slide 19. So we wanted to assess health effects ourselves, so we exposed pregnant female mice to a mixture of 23 commonly used fracking chemicals in their drinking water. We treated them from the 11th day of pregnancy, gestational day 11, for about a week through birth, and then assessed the health of their offspring in a number of ways at several time points through their development. We also included a vehicle control, which just includes the ethanol that we diluted our chemicals in, and an anti-androgen control group, which is thalidomide. Slide 20. So I won't belabor this slide, but this is a list of the 23 chemicals we included in our experiment and that we have previously shown, published in October, to be bioactive in our reporter gene assays in vitro. Slide 21. So one of the more interesting outcomes was that we observed increased body weights in both our male and female animals, and in many cases observed this throughout development at several ages. Just to orient you to what these concentrations mean, so importantly, not all of these 23 chemicals have well-reported concentrations in the environment. However, for chemicals that we do have information on, their concentrations in wastewater line up well with our high dose group, what we call mixed 3000. So our graphs are oriented from our vehicle control or zero concentration of our fracking chemicals up through our high concentration of fracking chemicals, and then on the far right, our anti-androgen control. So our mixed 3000 lines up well with wastewater concentrations. Gross et al. Published a study assessing several chemical concentrations underneath in groundwater underneath surface spills, and our next highest dose, mix 300, correlates well with those concentrations. And lastly, and perhaps most importantly, concentrations that we and others, including the Environmental Protection Agency, have now reported in people's drinking water in Pavilion and other regions match up well with our two lower doses, the MIX 3 and MIX 30. So here we have increased body weight in these mice exposed to realistic concentrations of drinking water contamination, so to say. Slide 22. Now, this data was published late last year, but in males we have also observed an increase in testis weight in these mice, a subsequent decrease in sperm count up to 33%, and also a dramatically altered serum testosterone level, in some cases more than 500% increased over the vehicle control, which is, and we saw the greatest effects in the highest fracking exposure group. Slide 23. In females and also in males, we see some increased heart weights. This effect is more pronounced in the males than it is in the females. In the males, so we further assessed this in both sexes, and we do see an increase in cardiac myocyte size in the hearts of our male mice. We don't see a significant increase in the females, but we do see an increased amount of collagen deposition in these hearts, suggesting some lasting impacts on the structural integrity. Slide 24. With Andrew Wolf at Johns Hopkins University, we've measured the number of serum hormones in the blood of our female mice. Ultimately, what we see across most of our groups is a shutdown of most pituitary hormone production. Prolactin is almost completely inhibited across doses, and follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone are inhibited in all but one of our experimental groups. Interestingly, this one dose, MIX 300, also has significantly elevated thyroid-stimulating hormone and growth hormone, and this group also matches up with one of our increased body weight groups. So lastly, slide 25, John Bromfield at University of Florida has helped us assess the ovarian follicle data in these mice, for which a great undergrad, Kara Klemp, did the extensive counting for. Ultimately, what we see here is a progression of follicle maturation from primordial down to antral, along with otretic at the bottom. Ovarian follicles develop from primordial first row down to antral, which is the second to last row, during the process of follicle selection. Each follicle contains an oocyte or egg cell that is then selected for and released at the termination of each cycle. Generally, what we're seeing here is a decrease in early stage follicles and an increased number of later stage follicles prepubertally. So this is the PND21 on the left side of this figure. By adulthood, we also see an increased rate of follicle atresia or death, suggesting that what we might be observing is inappropriate activation and ultimate death of the follicles and not an accelerated pubertal development. Slide 26. In summary, some chemicals used in and produced by oil and gas operations can interfere with the endocrine system. Humans and animals are likely exposed to these chemicals through multiple routes in these areas. It isn't just water. Numerous studies show increases in air contamination near these sites as well, and dermal absorption is also a concern for people bathing and living with this water. Injection sites may represent another route through which oil and gas operations may influence endocrine-disrupting chemical contributions to surface and groundwater. And lastly, gestational exposure to a mixture of oil and gas operation chemicals at likely environmentally relevant concentrations resulted in adverse health outcomes in C57 mice, including increased body weights, reduced sperm counts, suppressed hormones, altered ovarian follicle development, and more. Ultimately, a lot more work needs to be done on these endpoints and in other models to work out exactly what mechanisms are contributing to these observed impacts. Slide 27. With that, I'll stop and thank Susan and the rest of my PhD committee, as well as the rest of the Nagel Lab who played some role in this work along the way. Notably, Kara Klemp really stepped up to help me get the animal experiment done. I'd also be amiss if I didn't thank Heather Stapleton, my current postdoc advisor here at Duke, for being very supportive of my wrapping up of these final projects. Collaborators, we have a large number of active collaborations, and I can't possibly thank them all. The people whose work I discussed today include Chung-Ho Lin and Yan Vu at University of Missouri, who have done a lot of the chemistry, Irma Drobnis, who has helped a lot with male reproductive health assessments, Wade Davis, a biostatistician who has since moved on from MU that helped with a lot of the statistics, Andrew Wolf at Johns Hopkins University, who helped with the serum analysis, Tom Zeller at UMass, who has helped with thyroid endpoints, and John Bromfield at University of Florida, who helped with this ovarian follicle data. And of course, the group at USGS, who brought us in on this injection well study and who have their own papers who will be coming out before too long, so certainly keep an eye out for them. Lastly, I was funded under an EPA STAR predoctoral fellowship, which supported this work, along with grants from the Passport Foundation, the University of Missouri, and the crowdfunding campaign via experiment.com. Thanks again for listening, and I think we have some time for questions.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kasotis. That is truly groundbreaking work, and we're all so grateful that you're continuing to pursue this. We do have some very interesting questions on from our chat box. I am going to take a minute and announce our next two calls here just very quickly so that if people have to get off at the bottom of the hour, they can go ahead and do so. But Dr. Kasotis has said he has time to stay on for a few minutes past, and so if people want to stay on, they're welcome to. So our next two calls are on May 5th at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll hear from Dr. Shana Stacy about perinatal outcomes in Southwest Pennsylvania. And on June 2nd at 2 p.m., Dr. Nicole Diziel will present on the reproductive and developmental toxicity of chemicals in hydraulic fracturing fluids. So we'll be sending invitations for those two calls in the next couple of weeks. And I think now we can go straight to the questions. We have a comment and a question from Dr. Linda Birnbaum of the NIEHS. She mentioned early in your talk that indirect hormone action can also involve different transcription fractions, partners, et cetera, and not only what was listed on the slide. So you're welcome to respond to that, Dr. Kasotis, but I'm going to go ahead and read Dr. Birnbaum's question that she asked as well, so you can respond to both of them. And her question was, how was the 23 chemical mix constituted? Was it equimolar amount, which I imagine you'll have to explain, and or concentrations relative to what's in fracking fluid? Those were her follow-up questions on that. So if you could answer those, that would be great.
Yeah, so thank you for pointing that out. Definitely there are other indirect mechanisms that I did not point out on that slide. That's absolutely correct. As to the 23 mix of chemicals, these were all equal concentrations in the drinking water. So our 330, 300, and 3,000, this is an estimated exposure of microgram per kilogram per day. Those are equivalent to 0.01, 0.1, 1, or 10 milligrams per liter, and that's of each of the 23 chemicals in the drinking water. And sorry,
okay.
Just to follow up on that, yes, yeah, so as I hope I explained, our high concentration is then equivalent to concentrations reported in wastewater, and our two low groups are equivalent to concentrations reported in drinking water.
Great, thank you. So the next question from Tammy McMullen says, as I'm sure you're aware, the studies you've conducted are generally considered a Tier 1 evaluation in the EPA EDSP plan, Endocrine Disruptor Screening Program. If the weight of evidence is positive, then it triggers evaluation in a repro and or developmental study. Although your studies are with mixtures, have you evaluated the consistency of your in vitro and mice or in vivo data with results from full reproductive and developmental toxicological studies on many, if not all, of your chemicals listed in slide 20?
Yeah, so that's a big question. So yes, absolutely. I think one of the things that sticks out to us is that this is very much kind of a screening approach. So we have done the mechanistic work in vitro, looking at what mechanisms these chemicals might be working through. But our rodent study here is really very much a kind of exploratory study to determine what outcomes we may be looking at, may need to be looked at in greater detail in future studies. So Yeah, so while we have not done that with individual chemicals, it does make it a little bit difficult to work out the mechanism that the mixture might be working through, or the consistency with some of the available reproductive or developmental tox studies. But certainly we are interested in doing that.
Okay, thank you. Gonna circle back to one I missed. What criticisms of your study do you expect, and are there responses that you have thought of so far?
Yeah, so I think one of the criticisms that we have consistently got in the past is regarding the fact that we concentrate our water samples to assess the receptor activity. So largely we do this so that we can better assess that activity. So if we just use plain water in our system, we may not have the sensitivity to detect the activity that we are looking to assess. So in this study, we tried to address that through calculating equivalent concentrations of all our activities. So I hope I explained that well, but essentially moving from, say, 20% estrogenic activity in a 4X water sample to what would an equivalent concentration of 17-beta-estradiol be in that water at 1X concentration in our reporter gene assay system. And then being able to take that concentration and go to the literature and say, at what concentrations has 17-beta-estradiol been associated with adverse health effects in aquatic organisms, for example. So I hope that has tried to bridge the gap between that previous criticism and this work here.
Great. Thank you. There's a couple more specific questions. Robin Blakeman asks, is increased testosterone in males associated with increased aggressive behavior?
You know, I am not sure about the answer to that question. We have certainly not assessed behavior in these mice. I know that we have a number of active collaborations going on, and Susan's lab is moving forward, looking at a number of these outputs in much greater detail, and I know that behavior is one of those. I can't speak to whether those mice would have greater aggressive behavior then.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing those results in the behavioral test. Mark Kendra asks, are you aware of commercially available testing facilities to evaluate EDC concentrations? And if not, can Duke conduct the analysis for other researchers?
So importantly, all of the work that I presented here today was done at University of Missouri. So Dr. Chung-Ho Lin is the chemist that we have worked with there, and he is certainly capable of detecting all of these chemicals that I presented today, and many more. He has developed quite a suite of oil and gas chemicals. There are certainly commercially available testing facilities to evaluate chemical concentrations, including many of the chemicals that I talked about today. In terms of specifically endocrine disrupting chemical concentrations, if we're talking about activity, I can't speak to that. I'm not sure.
Okay. We've got questions continuing to come in. The next one is, did your flutamide dose correspond with the activity of one of your treatment doses? How did you choose the flutamide concentration? And that comes from Joe Rochester.
Yeah, thanks. So the flutamide dose did it correspond with the activity of one of my treatment doses. So certainly for specific outcomes, the resultant the magnitude of the effect that we observed in the mice was the same as we observed with flutamide, but for other outcomes that we measured, it was not. So we chose the concentration just based on existing literature. It seemed to be a commonly used concentration for mice. The circling back around to this previous question, in terms of mechanistically, while we certainly were interested in anti-androgenic mechanisms of disruption in the animals, we couldn't possibly include controls for all of the types of receptor inhibition that we measured in vitro. We couldn't do an animal study that large.
Understandable. Okay, I'm going to read two more because we've got you on the line and I don't want to miss the opportunity, and then we'll stop. So Tom Brule says, I'm curious as to why 4-NQO was not chosen as one of the EDCs since it was found in amounts in most every sample of the larger number of wells across West Virginia and Pennsylvania during New York State's extensive study of high-volume horizontal fracking.
Yeah, thanks for that question. That's really interesting. I'm not familiar with that chemical. So the answer to that is just largely a lot of this data was not available when we started down this road. So I started this work back in 2010, and largely at that point we just had the information from the endocrine disruption exchange on the chemicals that were present. The congressional report came out in 2011, but really it wasn't until 2012, 2013 where we started to get some sense of how frequently some of these chemicals were used. Certainly we have more than 1,000 chemicals now reported by EPA across the country for hydraulic fracturing. So we have a long way to go in assessing these chemicals, and I think that looks like a promising one for future investigations.
Yes, thank you. So the last question, are the chemicals that you identified bioaccumulative? And if so, what are the human health implications over a 30 to 60 year lifespan, given a lifetime of exposure in water, for example?
That's
a loaded question.
I do not know the answer to that question. Certainly, some chemicals that we have looked at are bioaccumulative, but I could not say that for all of them. And in terms of human health implications, I think that's a black box at this point. Certainly, we've seen a lot of anecdotal reports or increased health concern reports in these areas. And we have seen a couple epidemiological studies right now, but very few people have been looking at human health in these regions. And I think only time will tell.
Yes, and I that's why we're doing what we're doing here at TEDx and trying to get this science out into the public as quickly as it's coming out, because there's not so much. I will say Linda Birnbaum responded to that question and saying things don't have to be bioaccumulative to have chronic impact if exposure occurs over a lifetime.
Absolutely.
A point there for people to be aware of. So I'm going to thank our speaker again, Dr. Kasotis. Thank you so very much. And everyone, be sure to keep an eye on your email for our invitation to the next two calls. And I'm going to turn this over to Chris Ribbons for closing comments.
Thank you, Carol. I want to make sure that everyone knows that there will be an MP3 recording of this call available on our website soon. We encourage you to share it with others. I would also like to remind you again of the next call in our series that will be on Thursday, May 5th at 2 p.m. Eastern, and will feature Dr. Shana Stacy, who will discuss perinatal outcomes associated with natural gas operations in Pennsylvania. Please mark your calendars and register for the call from our website soon. We will send out an email announcing when registration is open. Again, I would like to thank Dr. Kasotis for taking the time to present his research, Carol, our moderator, And thank you to all of the participants for taking the time out of your day to join us. I hope that you all have a wonderful rest of your day.